favorite childhood advice?
You've got a lot of company. You're not alone in that regard. In fact, of all the sermons I've ever prepared and set out to find some cover art for a slide, this is the one where overwhelmingly every picture I saw was in the form of a cartoon. And you can tell that all of the preparation was done aimed at children, because Zacchaeus is a great children's Bible story, right? First of all, it's a great story with the detail everyone remembers. And there's a pretty snappy little tune that goes along with it as well, right? We sing that song about Zacchaeus in our VBS class. And in fact, I think Nathan was going to lead it this morning, but he's afraid he couldn't remember the hand motions. So he elected not to do that. But what I wanted to challenge you to think about this morning is that the story of Zacchaeus is more than a kid's story. And there are some very grown-up lessons. And I hope when we get done here, you'll be impressed with the fact that there's more to Zacchaeus than the fact that he was a wee little man. And so we're going to talk this morning about big lessons from a little man here in Luke chapter 19. If you're reading along with me, we're just going to look at these 10 verses that David read for us. And it begins in the narrative, Jesus walking through the city of Jericho on his way to Jerusalem, ultimately go up to Jerusalem and to die. And he runs into a man named Zacchaeus that we're introduced to here very early in chapter 19. And his Jewish name, Zacchaeus, means pure. Pure. Think about that for a second. Then file that away. But I would suggest to you that as people who know the story, it probably crosses your mind that it may be that he had not been exactly living up to his name for at least this portion of his life. And we find that out because there we also find in verse 2 what he does for a living. We find out that this man was an agent for Rome. And so that just reminds us that we're in the period of world history where the Roman Empire controlled all of the known world, including Judea there. So it was Rome who had the power to levy and collect taxes. And their system was when they did that, they would employ locals to take care of that for them. So now that explains why every time you read about tax collectors in the New Testament, they're not portrayed in a very favorable light. That's why they were considered a social outcast and were viewed as traitors. Because here's a Jew, and to the other Jews, it would be seen as, you're working for the oppressor. And you're getting rich off of the backs of your brothers. So we'd understand why there was this animosity toward tax collectors by fellow Jews there in Judea in the first century. But we're told that Zacchaeus was one of these guys. He was a tax collector. But I think sometimes when we talk about Zacchaeus, we would say that was the sum total of his biography. But let me suggest to you that it's not. It's a very important detail we find out in verse 3. Zacchaeus was seeking. Zacchaeus was a seeker. And we use that word sometimes. And I think it's very important that we see this. I think it's a very good translation. The ESV uses this word, seeking. Other translations say something like he sought to see or was trying to see. And when you read that, then you're just kind of, I think, stuck on a surface level, as if all Zacchaeus wanted to do was lay his eyes on Jesus, as if he would be satisfied just with visual contact. And I think there's so much more to it than that, and I think the rest of the story will bear that out. I think the definition of the word bears that out. If you think about what he's doing when he's seeking, he is investigating. And Zacchaeus has this desire to reach a binding and terminal or a final impactful conclusion about this man. He's got in mind something besides just seeing him. In fact, I think for now, and I'm going to remember it this way based on the definition of the story, Zacchaeus climbed to the top of a tree to get to the bottom of a matter. He was seeking Jesus. And I think that language and that understanding of the language is borne out in that idea. He was seeking to see who Jesus was. See, it doesn't just say he was seeking to see Jesus, again, which would give us the idea that maybe he literally wanted visual contact with the man. No, he wanted to see who he was. And by saying it that way, that adds depth to it, I think. I think it makes us realize he was more interested in not just seeing the man, but the substance of the man. Who is this Jesus? Zacchaeus had to have heard about him, And he had his desire to go find out for himself about this itinerant preacher that was going around, this traveling teacher that was certainly being talked about by the people he came in contact with on a daily basis. And probably Zacchaeus thought, maybe this man is a prophet. That's what a lot of my countrymen say, those who have heard him, those who have seen him. They think maybe he's a prophet. Or maybe Zacchaeus even thought, perhaps this is the Messiah. There are some who were maybe wondering that themselves. Maybe he had heard that. Maybe he had hopes that this was that long anticipated son of David that he knew the law and the prophets had promised to send his people. But what I want us to remember about Zacchaeus here at the beginning was he was seeking to see who Jesus was. And he would not be held back. And that's really going to be the focus of our discussion this morning. We'll talk about three ways in which he manifests this, but Zacchaeus would not be held back. And let me suggest to you first that he was not held back by what he had. If you go on and read there in verse 2, you find out that not only was he a tax collector, he was a chief tax collector. And we read about other tax collectors in the New Testament. Zacchaeus is the only man that's described this way, that we know that he was a chief tax collector. And if you know anything again about the Roman system of taxation, it was a series of contractors and subcontractors that they hired to do this. Well, Zacchaeus is on top of that pyramid here in and around Jericho. So Zacchaeus was connected. Zacchaeus was important. Zacchaeus was somebody. He had status. He had position. He had clout in and around Jericho. And I want you to just think about that idea. I think you realize sometimes that could be an obstacle that prevents people from seeking Jesus. The lure of position in this world and all the things that go with it. And let me suggest to you that sometimes those of us who begin seeking Jesus can be drawn away in a desire for status and position. Attainment on the climbing the corporate ladder or being well known in the community begin to cloud our vision and our perspective about things. But not Zacchaeus. And you may think, yeah, he had all this status, Bob, but the guy was hated. I say, yeah, you're right. I think the story bears that out. But let me suggest to you that part of that hatred may just have been envy, because he was also rich. You know, Zacchaeus was a very wealthy man. That stands to reason. So he had, he sat at the top of the organization in charge of collecting taxes for Jericho and the regions about that. And that was a kind of like a pyramid. He got a little taste of everything. And if you know anything about the geography of Judea, Jericho was the first major town on the west side of the Jordan. And a road called the King's Highway crossed the Jordan just east of Jericho and ran through Jericho on its way north and south through Judea. Well, that was one of the three major trade routes in the ancient Near East that ran through Palestine. So what that means is at this time, anything coming from the vast eastern expanses of the Roman Empire headed to Jerusalem and ultimately maybe even on to Egypt came through Jericho. So Zacchaeus, we got a little taste of that. And conversely, anything, all the wealth or the resources that left Egypt or Judea and headed anywhere to the vast eastern expanses of the Roman Empire would have went through Jericho to go before they went down and crossed the Jordan River if they were traveling along the King's Highway. And Zacchaeus would have got a cut of that. So he was a very rich, a very wealthy man. And again, I don't think I have to tell you that how wealth can be an obstacle for those who would see Jesus. You know, Jesus talks about that. And there are those who will try to serve another master. And he says you can't serve two. You can't serve God and mammon, God and money, God and stuff. And there'll be some that the love for wealth and the desire to attain wealth and riches and money, the things money can buy, will be an obstacle that will hold them back from ever seriously seeking Jesus. And let me suggest that for those of us, again, that are attempting to seek Jesus, it can become an obstacle. You may recall from the parable of the sower, Jesus talked about how the cares of this world, which certainly focusing on wealth or the accumulation of wealth or keeping what I've accumulated, it can distract us, can become those tares, those things that grow up in our heart and choke out the word of God in our hearts. Certainly we know how wealth and the pursuit of wealth and the love of money and the love of the things money can buy can hold us back in our efforts to seek Jesus. But if you look at Zacchaeus here on the surface level, you'd have to say he seemed to have it all. Here's this guy, he's got a great position. He's got status, he's got position. He's rich. Here's a man who seems to have it all, yet notice he was seeking what he didn't have. Zacchaeus is seeking peace. Seeking hope. See, Zacchaeus was somebody, but he's somebody who didn't care as much about who he was as who Jesus was. And Zacchaeus was seeking Jesus and would not be held back by what he had. Similarly, we learn that he was not held back by what others thought. You read there in verse 4, probably the most well-known part of the story here. We're told that he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree. So this is the image that sticks in our minds is that what makes the story so interesting. And I want you to think about that now. That's not very dignified, is it? Grown-ups, think about that. So here's this man of wealth and of power, would have been known locally, would have been famous or infamous, depending on your perspective. And you know, he would have been expected probably to carry himself in a dignified manner. He probably thought of himself as rather dignified. He's important and he's rich, right? Important rich people usually tend to carry themselves in a way that would make you realize they're important and rich. Why? Because they realize they're important and rich, right? And so think about the humility it takes, grown-ups, as someone who's perceived and wants to be considered dignified, the willingness to run along behind a crowd and try to tiptoe and see something. Or run along and jump up and down trying to see something. And then there in public in front of everybody, you realize that's not going to work. And you literally run ahead of the trail and you climb a tree right there in front of all the citizens of Jericho. I think the crowd might have been jeering a little bit at him there. That's not very dignified, is it? He's really kind of, as we would say, putting himself out there. And he had to know that. That's probably the way he wouldn't have behaved normally, but he would not let what others thought hold him back. And it made me think of something that we need to think about that principle more than we do probably. Maybe particularly in the day and age that we live in. Because that's something that is consistent always with Jesus' followers. And many of you know this passage, but some of you may not. I want you to turn to this one passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 this morning. So I want you to think about this. The willingness to appear as undignified. And we've talked some lately, particularly maybe in our evidence classes, about how the world perceives us. And that there's always the chance now that those who are intellectuals in this world will sneer at Christians. Will think it's ridiculous, some of the things we believe. Either the morals that we believe or things our understanding of our view of creation or the universe and those kind of things. And that's what Paul has in mind when he's talking to the Corinthians here. And he's telling them, this phrase on the slide there says, consider your calling, brethren. And really for this whole section, Paul's dealing with these people in Corinth saying, hey, what you believe seems kind of foolish to the rest of the world, doesn't it? And when he says, consider your calling, basically saying, hey, look around the auditorium. Look around the auditorium. Let's read verse 20, 1 Corinthians 1. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? And Paul makes it more clear, move down to verse 26. It says, for consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. See, that's who this appeals to. You got to be willing to be considered not dignified by the world around you. Verse 27 says, why? But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. Zacchaeus had this willingness to not care what others thought when it came to his determination to see Jesus. And so that's where we have him there in verse 4 back in Luke chapter 19, is up in that sycamore tree. And then in verse 5, as Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. And I think the most impressive thing about that verse there to me is the word must. That Jesus seems to be about something here. And I think when we get to the end of the little story here, we'll see what that is. This isn't just a happenstance meeting, perhaps. And you know, Jesus walks right up and says to him and calls him by name. And then he says, Zacchaeus, it's imperative. I must go to your house today. And what I suggest to you, that Jesus there, the Son of God, is showing us that he not only did he know that man's name, but he knew that man's heart. And I think that comes out in the rest of the story as well. Then look at verse 6. Again, very terse, very succinct, just a few words. But look what Luke decides to tell us here, talking to Zacchaeus now. So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And I think just in that little bitty verse there, we learn something else about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus hurried and came down. What did Jesus told him to do? Hurry and come down. You see, he does exactly what Jesus told him to do. And I think there we even see a lesson there about the humility it took to just translate into simple, straightforward obedience. Exactly what Jesus told him to do, Luke records, that's exactly what he did. And again, think about the humility that shows in this man, one of the more prominent citizens of the city. And this itinerant preacher comes in and orders him to come down out of the tree and invites himself to his house. And verse 6 says, and he received him joyously, joyfully. You know something rich and powerful people are not good at? Being told what to do. But here's Zacchaeus here in front of, again, everybody in town. Jesus walks up and says, hurry, come down. I need to go to your house. And that's exactly what Zacchaeus does. He didn't care what his neighbors thought. He didn't care to come down out of that tree and take orders from this son of a carpenter. But I think there's a very important phrase here at the end of verse 6 that I haven't always picked up on as well. So Jesus said, I must stay at your house today. And verse 6 ends by telling us he received him joyfully. And I think how I'd always understood this story previously that was that it all takes place in a single scene at the base of that tree that Zacchaeus had climbed up. But I don't understand it that way now. Because Jesus said, I must come into your house. And verse 6 tells us that happened. So what I think here is at the end of verse 6, we have a change in scene. That Zacchaeus climbs down and takes Jesus and his disciples, those traveling with him, and now he heads off and takes them into his house. And I think that's borne out by the reaction we see in verse 7. Because now you see what the people say. They're giving commentary on what Jesus has done. And in verse 7 it says, he has gone into to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. So I think that's the crowd on the street who's just watched Jesus' disciples walk away and go in the direction of, if not into, Zacchaeus' house. And this is what the people say about that. And that's a comment about Jesus, but really you understand that that criticism of Jesus is really about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is the sinner. He's not worthy to have Jesus in his house, is the thought of the citizenry there in Jericho. Why would Jesus go into that guy's house? So you see that's what other people thought about Zacchaeus. And he would have known that. He would have known how people felt about him, but he didn't let that stop him. But I think there's another lesson here for us. Some people don't want us to escape our past. Think about that crowd out there. They didn't want Zacchaeus to have any part of Jesus. They didn't consider him worthy of that. And I think we can run into attitudes like that. Maybe you might see that in someone who you perceive to be self-righteous or holier than thou, and you get the feeling they think you're not worthy to be a Christian. You're not good enough to be one of us. Maybe you see that in the exact opposite direction. The people who you used to run around with, but now you're trying to do different and do better, but they don't want you to. Because you do better, it makes what they do bad. The fact you're changing makes the fact they won't change and don't change makes them feel guilty. And they don't want you to escape your past. Well, let me suggest, no matter which way that cuts, whatever your experience is, if we want to seek Jesus, realize that some people don't want us to escape our past. But we're going to have to find a way to escape those people. If we truly want to seek Jesus, we can't be held back by what others think. And Zacchaeus wasn't. And also, he wasn't held back. Last one we'll look at is by what he had done. And so verse 8, if we think about it, again, I typically used to view this as a response to the crowd's observation in verse 7. But knowing now that Zacchaeus and Jesus and Jesus' traveling party has been removed off the scene, we don't know how much time passes between verse 7 and verse 8, to tell you the truth. So what I think is more likely now is Zacchaeus has taken Jesus and disciples into his house, and they've been there for some amount of time. Perhaps he's fed them. But whatever else has or hasn't happened, if Jesus has been alone with a group for any amount of time, what do you think was happening? Jesus was teaching them about the kingdom. And so let me suggest to you that verse 8 is not Zacchaeus' response to what the people are murmuring about. It's Zacchaeus' response to Jesus' teaching about the kingdom. And at some point in response to what Jesus had to say, Zacchaeus decided he wanted to change. Verse 8 says, Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." So sometimes there's an understanding, or some understand this verse to be saying, or even translated maybe to say, "I've always done this." And I've heard people try to explain away, "Well, Zacchaeus wasn't that bad a guy. See, he's always given half of his..." But I don't think that bears out with the context here. Think about it like this. If Zacchaeus had been the kind of guy who always gave half of what he had to the poor, would the people of Jericho have thought badly of him? Would they have thought of him as a sinner? I mean, even you get to think about Cornelius, even though he was a Roman centurion, the Jews in the area had good things to say about him because he was a good man. So I just don't think it bears out that Zacchaeus is talking about what he has done in the past. I think this is a proclamation. In response to what you've shared with me, Jesus, this is what I'm going to do. And the translation of some versions bears this out. The NIV here in this place begins this verse by saying, "Here and now I give half of my goods to the poor." And even in the New American Standard, you can see the future tense of it. "I will give." And what we're talking about here is that Zacchaeus has come to a point where he's ready to change. You might say it, verse 8 looks a whole lot like repentance. Something about the message that Jesus has shared with him has caused Zacchaeus to see the need and have a desire to change. And he wanted to change. He didn't let what he had done keep him from following Jesus. I want you to think about that just a second, that I think we can do that sometimes. One of the saddest situations I've ever been with is to sit across the table from somebody and try to talk to them about the gospel to find out they're convinced that they've done something so bad they can't be forgiven. That they're convinced that they're so sinful there's no way God can forgive them. What may be even sadder to me is to see Christians that stumble and then get pulled down by the guilt of that. Because as Christians, ostensibly we're convinced of God's mercy and God's grace and God's willingness to forgive. Yet sometimes I see Christians struggle with that idea. And let me suggest, if we know who God is and what God will do, if we have any lack of faith in his willingness to forgive us, it really then becomes a lack of faith in the blood of his son. John said, "Cleanses us from all sin." But Zacchaeus wouldn't let what he had done hold him back. In fact, he was willing to make things right. It's the principle of restitutions at play there in verse 8. And I just want you to think about this. Again, an overwhelming demonstration of where Zacchaeus was at this moment. When he says, hey, if I have cheated anybody, I'm willing to make restitution. And you know, the law, as a Jew, he would have been governed by the law of Moses. And the law would say that if you defraud someone, restitution is 100% plus one-fifth. So what I'm saying is if Sean Brewer came to me and said, hey, Bob, I think you've defrauded me of $100, and we get the ledger out and we figure out that's the case, I say, Sean, you're right, I'll give you $120 is what the law would require. Zacchaeus is saying, if I've done that, I'm going to give him $400. Do you see that? That's the spirit that Zacchaeus is demonstrating here at this point. And so what I want you to think about is, why would he do that? Why such a change comes over this man from who he was when this story started to who he is now when he stands up and tells Jesus, here's what I'm going to do. And let me suggest, he truly saw Jesus for who he was. He accomplished what he was seeking to do. And I think Jesus tells us the answer there in his comment in verse 9. Jesus said, today salvation has come into this house. I think there's a sense when perhaps you might think Jesus is simply talking about himself. He is the personification of salvation in every possible way. And Jesus has now visited this house. But I think probably contextually he's talking about what's happened in and for Zacchaeus. That salvation here is because Jesus and the mercy of Jesus has met with the faith of this man. And now salvation has come to this house. And then it's almost as if Jesus turns to his disciples who were probably there with him. Maybe even some of the people that worked for, maybe even some of Zacchaeus' servants and staff who kind of thought he was a bad guy. And Jesus says there in verse 9, talking of Zacchaeus, says he is also a son of Abraham. And so what Jesus would have been reminding even his disciples, you got to think, they're all Jews from around Judea. They probably didn't like tax collectors either. They probably had those same preconceived notions and prejudices against tax collectors. There's probably some of them following Jesus into the house going, what are we going in this guy's house for? He is a sinner. Those people were right. But Jesus turns to them and says, he too is a son of Abraham. He may be a tax collector, but he's a Jew. And as a descendant of Abraham, he has the right to the same hope and the promises of Abraham. He has the right to share in the same blessings of the promises of Abraham, of the Messiah that was to come. And Jesus wanted his disciples to understand that. But let me suggest for us as well that that term, son of Abraham, here I think Jesus primarily used it to remind them he was a physical descendant of Abraham. But I want you to think about the significance that term takes on later in the New Testament. You remember what Paul says in Galatians chapter 3, who the true children of Abraham are? You're true children of Abraham through faith. So all of us, Christians, are the true sons of Abraham through faith. And I want you to consider that today Zacchaeus has become both. The Zacchaeus today is a child, a son of Abraham because he shares DNA from Abraham, but also now because he shares a faith like Abraham. And then finally, Luke 19 verse 10, I want you to understand the purpose statement Jesus makes there. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. And again, I think that's why Jesus used the word must earlier. Because this was an opportunity to do just that. He must do it because this is what he came to do. And I want you to listen to Jesus. Because Jesus is giving you his purpose statement here. And let me suggest to you, there are a lot of other voices and causes out there that will try to compete with that. They'll try to convince you this is what Jesus came to do. This is what Jesus was about. Let me tell you what Jesus said Jesus was about. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. He didn't come to do something else. He didn't come to end poverty. didn't come to end physical suffering, cure disease. He came to seek and save what was lost. And remember that. Jesus said that. Think about it this way. In this episode here, Jesus didn't come to dismantle an oppressive and unfair Roman taxation system. He came to change the heart of one little tax collector. And that's what he did. And that's the story of Zacchaeus. So when you think about Zacchaeus in the future, let me suggest to you that I think ultimately and finally, he lived up to his name. You remember what his name meant? Pure. Turns out, gave him a kind of surface look, we may have missed it, but it turns out he has a good heart, doesn't he? And we learn in the story of Zacchaeus, we'll pay attention to the details, that he was determined to seek. He wanted to see who Jesus really was, and he wouldn't allow himself to be held back. He wouldn't be held back by what he had. He wouldn't be held back by what others thought. And he wouldn't let the past become an obstacle to a future. He wouldn't be held back by what he had done because of what he was trying to do. He was seeking to see who Jesus was. And let me suggest to you, when you truly see who Jesus is, it's life-changing. And that's the only explanation for the story of Zacchaeus. He truly saw who Jesus was. And I want you to think about one more thing, because it occurs to me that Zacchaeus is really an illustration of one of the Beatitudes. When you think about Zacchaeus, remember what Jesus said. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Let me suggest to you, that's what Zacchaeus said. Big lessons from a little man. There's so much more to Zacchaeus than the fact he was a wee little man. Let me ask you this morning, do you have a pure heart? Here's a good follow-up question to help with that. Are you seeking to see Jesus, to see who he really is? Do you know and believe that he came to seek and save you? What have you done about it? If you're subject to the invitation this morning, let us know how we can help you by coming forward now while we stand and while we sing.